Welcome to Cairo Nights. Newsboss Frank Shires is here, as is Shane Peterson, chairman of the board. I am Mike Lewis. We've got a busy show tonight. Whole bunch of news. Tiger Woods, which you've probably heard about, at least whom you've probably heard about. Well, he had a pretty bad day, and we're getting more details on what exactly happened in the auto accident that he was in. We're also going to be talking about a bunch of other stuff, that flight over that jettisoned engine parts over Colorado. We're going to have a conversation about that later on, and it turns out that while it is bad, it may not be as bad as you think. And also, we have conflicting news stories in the same paper, Seattle Times. They're both good news stories, and they're not really in conflict, except one is that no one is moving to Seattle, or people have stopped moving into Seattle. The other one is that housing prices keep going up, so we're going to try and solve that mystery, and I can promise you one thing, we won't. So, let me get on to what the big news of the day. Well, the big news of the day is a couple of things, but a lot of it, of course, coronavirus. And at some point in, I don't know, 2022, when we just do the occasional retrospective story on this, we will stop talking about it. But while it's here, and while we're in the middle of it, and we are certainly in the middle of it, we are going to continue to talk about it. And this is about study out of California on yesterday, actually, a COVID-19 variant that originated in California appeared in half the samples from the 44 of the state's counties. That's 50%. So it's already the predominant strain there. There are signs that it causes severe disease and spreads very quickly. This is from KPIX TV's Andrea Nakano.
UCSF teamed up with Chan Zuckerberg BioHub, which looked into cases in San Francisco's Mission District.
In November, this variant in the community was about 16% of positive cases. And then when we sampled during the weeks of January 11th to the 27th, it was fully 53%.
The California variant is one of four major ones circulating in the state.
We're going to keep seeing variants forever from this virus. Viruses mutate. They mutate all the time.
Dr. Anthony Fauci says the best way to beat this pandemic is with a unified approach.
We still need to get the overwhelming majority of the population vaccinated.
Which is actually, we've got a little bit more news about that. There is some good news on the vaccine front, but let's talk about this variant for a moment. It's referred to as the B1351 variant of the new coronavirus. It was first seen in South Africa in December. It was identified through a genomic sequencing at the UW Medicine Virology Department. It has been found in 10 states. It's now in King County. And 19 additional cases of the variant first found in the UK have been, an additional 19 have been identified. According to the Washington State Department of Health, the B117 strain, first identified in the UK, seems to spread more easily and quickly than other variants. And we've talked about this in the past. That was the big concern. And frankly, it's the concern if you think that, for example, from a restaurant industry standpoint or a gym standpoint, any other businesses affected by the phasing in and phasing out schools standpoint, although the schools, my guess, are pretty much locked in on a reopening plan of varying speeds. But the businesses are not. They are beholden to whatever the state decides. And this new variant is one of those things that could move us from phase two back to phase one, depending on how quickly it spreads and how sick people are getting when they get it and the percentage of population that actually gets a vaccination. The appearance of these variants, according to the Seattle Times, were not a surprise to Dr. Jeff Duchin, who you just heard quoted during the news segment. He's the public health officer for Seattle and King County, and he said in a briefing Tuesday that that this is what is expected. He said the same, echoed Anthony Fauci's comments that these variants are going to happen. This one is, it does have an additional concern, in, given that it seems to be more aggressive and more contagious. It is not a universally held opinion that it does make you sicker, although it does appear in early data to do so. Duchin said that the new strains of the coronavirus should prompt people to double down on their efforts to prevent the COVID-19 transmissions. According to the Seattle Times, he said that I'm sorry, this is from Acting State Health Officer Scott Lundquist. He said, detection of these COVID-19 variants in our state reminds us that the pandemic isn't over. Despite the decrease in our state case count, we are very concerned about the emergence of these new variants and how it will affect future case counts. And so what they're saying essentially is keep doing what you're doing. The patient with the South African variant tested positive for the coronavirus on January 29th, but could not be reached through contact tracing efforts. And therefore, health officials do not know details such as this person's travel history since it was diagnosed. So these are all the safety guidelines. You know them. The well-made, well-fitting masks. Remember, they say that doubling masks, so one sort of surgical grade, one cloth mask, really puts you at about a 95% effective rate as far as masks go, limiting those times indoors, all of the stuff that you already know, the frequent, thorough hand washing, all of that is a part of it. So what about those vaccines? Well, the heads of five COVID vaccine companies told lawmakers at a House subcommittee there will be hundreds of millions of vaccine doses available by the end of July. This is CBS News correspondent Allison Keyes.
The companies, including Pfizer, say there had been production delays, partly because they're making a new product to battle an illness that didn't exist until just over a year ago. But Dr. Richard Nettles of Johnson & Johnson says once his company's vaccine gets emergency use authorization from the FDA,
we're extremely focused on delivering that 100 million doses by the end of June.
Executives at AstraZeneca and Novavax say they are ready to start delivering vaccines once the FDA approves their products. Allison Keyes, CBS News, Washington.
So the White House also said on Tuesday that weekly shipments of coronavirus vaccines to the states would rise by 1 million doses to 4.5 million as vaccine manufacturers continue to ramp up production. This is according to the New York Times, that figure was provided to governors in a call to Jeffrey Zients, the president's coronavirus response coordinator. The White House press secretary on Tuesday said tens of millions of eligible Americans are waiting to get shots. State officials have been clamoring for more vaccine, and health practitioners are beginning to schedule more and more people for vaccines, although it still is operating with the older folks. Folks in with compromised immune systems, folks with multi-generation households, those still remain the priority. The other problem that seems to have been cleared up was the logistical issues regarding the severe snowstorms, Texas and elsewhere, that locked down a distribution of the vaccine last week. The average number of daily doses has gone back up since then to what we were seeing prior to the bad weather. And Pfizer and Moderna have both said that they're getting much more efficient at their production. Again, like you heard the quote just recently, and I think that's an important point. This vaccine did not exist at all 1 year ago today. And so the issues with not just developing it, getting it manufactured, and getting it out by the tens and hundreds of millions is a pretty remarkable bit of effort. And but it's always going to be fits and starts whenever you have something moving along that quickly. I know I am personally pretty excited to get a vaccine at some point. I also know I'm probably relatively low on the list, so I'm going to try and keep it steady as she goes until I get there. But I'm certainly hoping that I can at least get on a list by sometime in April. But I guess we'll see when that happens and if that happens. Mayor Eric Garcetti of Los Angeles said vaccinations would start back up again today at all city-run sites, and he indicated that people whose inoculations had been delayed by the weather would be given priority over those making new appointments. And at the congressional hearing also today, top officials from Pfizer reiterated the previous supply commitments in front of lawmakers. Both firms had earlier promised to deliver a total 400 million doses by the end of May, weeks ahead of schedule, and a total of 600 million by the end of July. And it looks like they are on track. At least they say they are. They are on track to do this. And one more bit of news. Well, actually, this isn't going to be one more. This is going to be one more bit today. This is going to be a series of news events over the course of the next couple of weeks with Senate hearings on the rioting in the Capitol. This is from CBS News reporter Stacey Lynn. She has details from Capitol Hill.
Several officials testified they knew about a possible threat before January 6 and had planned accordingly. Former House Sergeant at Arms Paul Irving said they believed the plan met the threat.
We now know that we had the wrong plan.
Ex-Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sun.
I think there's a failure of having a wide enough lens to look at what are the current threats that we're facing.
And acting D.C. Police Chief Robert Conti agreed.
The intelligence did not make it where it needed to be.
Another hearing will be held next week with Pentagon officials testifying. Stacey Lynn, CBS News, Capitol Hill.
So the you're going to be hearing a lot about those three Capitol security officials. All three have since resigned as a result of the Capitol riots, getting a fair bit of blame for not being prepared for the event. But at the testimony, they deflected responsibility at the hearing and for the security failures that contributed to the January 6th riot, blaming other agencies, each other, and at one point, even a subordinate for the breakdowns that allowed hundreds of Trump supporters to storm the Capitol. The testimony illustrated the chaos of the day, suggesting that officials were reluctant to accept responsibility for the politically charged issue, calling in the National Guard troops, even as the violence escalated. And if you listen to some of the testimony today, what you would hear a lot of is this lack of anticipation that these folks would actually turn on the Capitol. And I think that this is that one pivot there, I think, is going to turn out to be one of the more interesting aspects of this. And this is why if you saw, like, I don't know how many is now, what are we up to, 6 or 7 Seattle police officers who attended this? There was an unusual amount, disproportionate, according to the numbers, ratio of law enforcement, ex-law enforcement, and ex-military at this particular event in the Capitol. Now, I don't know how many of those folks actually made it inside. I think we'll find that information out later. But clearly sympathetic to this idea that there needed to be some sort of uprising to prevent what they apparently believed of as election fraud and reinstall a president who had lost the election. But the more interesting thing is that if this had been the same number of members of Antifa or Black Lives Matter or any number of other groups and not the Oath Keepers, I think they are, and the Proud Boys and a few other folks like that, and just some general political supporters, it's unclear to me that they would have been as ill prepared, because I think that what they saw, and actually some of the interviews bear this out, they saw a group of people they felt were fundamentally, even if they weren't sympathetic to the Biden administration, they were sympathetic to the rule, to the laws in place, and the officers there, who some of whom expressed a bit of sympathy for the anger of the people. And I think that this is one of those things that we're going to find is going to be a key moment here. I think because they felt like, well, perhaps this is a sympathetic group of people, perhaps they will be noisy and angry and loud, but they certainly wouldn't attack us, I think is going to be one of the things you're going to find unspooling. It seems to be coming out of more and more testimony and more interviews as people talk about this. And I think that this is going to prove to be a real bellwether on this idea that there are folks in official positions who have some measure of sympathy for the people who feel, the people who were rioting and who felt very, you know, I don't know, angry, disenfranchised, lied to, whatever it is. I think that we're going to find that this is going to, that teasing that out, that finding out that lack of preparation wasn't a lack of knowledge. It was a massive and incorrect assumption about who these folks were and what their sensibilities were. But we'll find out, I guess, as we move ahead. The testimony also illustrated a gap between what the FBI, maybe a gap between what the FBI knew and what the other security officials did. Some of the officials testified that the FBI and the intelligence community had failed to provide adequate warnings, that the rioters planned to seize the Capitol, and that the Pentagon was too slow to act after the attack began to authorize guard troops to help overwhelm police. They also gave their own conflicting accounts of communicating with each other as they sought to quell the riots in the early minutes. Quote, "None of the intelligence we received predicted what actually occurred." That was from former Capitol Police Chief Stephen A. Sund. He told this to senators. He called the riot the worst attack on law enforcement and our democracy that I have ever seen. And he said he witnessed insurrectionists assaulting officers not only with their fists, but with pipes, sticks, bats, metal barricades, and flagpoles. He said these criminals came prepared for war. That's what Mr. Sun said. The two other officials, former White House Sergeant-at-Arms Paul Irving and his Senate counterpart Michael Stegner, the top two security officials actually at the Capitol on that day, acknowledged their own mistakes as well. Ms. Sund admitted that his staff had never trained for such a wide-scale intrusion and lacked proper protective equipment. And I got to say, to his credit, I sympathize with that, because I don't think that anyone had really anticipated that to the degree that it happened. I think that was pretty clear. I don't know that there is any one person who needs, I mean, if someone had great information, didn't pass that along, well, that person certainly deserves some blame. But I think there was this broad disbelief that anything like this could actually happen in the Capitol. A month and a half after the siege is where we are right now. And the testimony is the first real hearing about all of this, and it's going to continue for the next few days. In fact, like you heard in the newscast, there is going to be Pentagon testimony as well, and I'm sure that they are going to push back on this idea, because there is a real conflict, and hopefully we'll be getting access, or reporters in D.C. will be getting access to phone records, because there seems to be a fairly sizable dispute on when the National Guard was requested and when the National Guard was actually sent, and whether or not the Pentagon even wanted to send the National Guard, because I think there was some concern that the optics of sending the National Guard out on people who were supporting President Trump while President Trump was still the president was problematic, and that initially the hope was that it was going to quiet down before it actually began. but it actually began escalating. And then it turned out that they were pretty ill prepared. The senators themselves called the lapses a, quote, failure of imagination, which is a little bit what we were talking about before. But I mean, pay attention to that phrase, because that's something that is going to come up time and time again. This idea that this one group, there was less to fear than another group, and thus we can prepare less for it. I think it put the lie to that whole notion. But we'll find out if really that was on people's minds as we move ahead. All right. Coming up, we've got Rachel Bell. I got a question for you. Do you have more than one refrigerator? If you are like me, we do. We have an extra little one in the basement. It turns out that we're getting to this weird place where we're averaging about two fridges a household. And do you know why? I don't, but Rachel does. And she'll be here with the story in just a few minutes. Please stay tuned. Grab some additional stuff out of. We have got this kind of smallish Euro fridge in our kitchen, and I was going to have to head downstairs, get something out of the little tiny, like, college fridge we have down there. And I was talking with it, like, just the whole idea, the ridiculousness of having two fridges. And then you send a story along, and apparently I am not alone. Apparently this is a thing.
So not alone. Okay, this is such a random story in the New York Times about people who have more than one refrigerator, which only the New York Times can drag this out to a very long article.
Exactly.
Love every word of it. Could I say that? So I'm going to start with a lot of numbers, just because all of these numbers just shocked me. Around 35 million U.S. households have two refrigerators. How is that possible? And then 6 million households in this country have more than two refrigerators. This comes from, actually, strangely, a federal agency, the Energy Information Administration, who keeps track of such things. So they broke it down even more. So people who make a lot more money, like over $140,000, are the most likely to have a fridge. But then it's even broken down by race and culture. So people of color also have second refrigerators and disproportionately high rates. It said nearly 20% of Black Americans have more than one, 22% of Latinos, 23% of Asian Americans, and a third of Native Americans who responded to this survey have more than one fridge. They told a story of this family where the parents live in one house and then the adult child lives next door with her partner. There's five people total. They have five fridges total, one for each person.
Wow.
And then, of course, when the pandemic started, people, just as they were hoarding toilet paper, started, you know, prepping, and people started buying freezers for their garage. And then when those completely sold out, they turned to refrigerators, which kind of doesn't make sense because, you know, in a huge disaster, there probably wouldn't be power. But anyway, that's how the story goes. So this just fascinated me because when I was a kid, I remember really wanting a second fridge in the garage because the few friends that I knew who had one, the fridge was full of junk food that my parents wouldn't buy. And so my tiny little bird brain child mind thought that if we had a second fridge, it would be full of soda and frozen corn dogs and pizza rolls and all of these things that I wasn't allowed to have.
And bagel dogs.
And oh, yeah, we had bagel dogs, of course. My family's company.
So I was thinking, right? That's why I brought it up. So the thing about the extra fridge, though, it seemed to me when I was reading the story as well, that I bet there's a correlation between the number of households that had those and the rise of the big box stores. Because you buy in, I mean, for example, if you go to Costco, especially if you like two people in my household and Vern, who's probably almost half a person, he's such a big cat. And then you have one person and one cat, correct, in your household. So not a need for like extra, you don't need to buy. But the fact is that if you do go to these stores or some other stores sell in these large containers now, that you feel like, all right, well, I can buy more in bulk. I can save a little bit of money, but you can clutter up, especially if you're in, you have just one fridge, you can clutter that up really quickly with stuff you're not moving through. And I bet that the big box stores had a lot to do with the expansion of a fridge and a freezer, you know, in every garage.
Well, yeah, it's a huge reflection on American culture because still in a lot of places of Europe, in Europe, people shop daily. You know, there's still a lot of places, even in Paris. I was speaking to a woman in Paris this week who said, you know, I go still to a butcher and then I go to the bakery and I go to the cheesemonger. And a lot of people still shop, you know, just for the meal they're making that day or maybe the next day. But in this culture, yeah, we go to Costco and we fill the fridge and we buy a lot of processed foods and we fill them. We fill the fridge with that. And it's kind of the same as like when I have a small purse, I only need a small purse. I put a few things in it. But when I have a big purse, I fill it up with like who knows what, you know? So I think it's the same. Like the more room you give yourself, the more you start to fill it. Because in this story, there's like an example of this woman who in her garage fridge only ever has, you know, a 6-pack or two of ginger ale. But she says, well, I just like knowing that it's in there just in case. So I think that Americans are like, even if you're not a full-on prepper, we're still kind of preppers compared to Europeans.
Well, yeah. I mean, that is part of that. The whole idea that what if a group of friends suddenly drops over? I'll have plenty of stuff and I won't have to go to the store that's four blocks away after they get here. It is a little bit like that. I mean, we own a bar, and why we have like a fridge full of beer at home, I have no idea. I mean, we buy a lot, thousands of dollars in beer. We do not need to have any at home. But, you know, we get these samples or you buy some or you have friends over, friends bring it over when they come over and whatever. And then you get, and then pretty soon you're thinking like, man, I could use an extra fridge. And we have got this little kind of downstairs, it's kind of half apartment, half basement room, but it's got its own entrance and its own bathroom and things like that. And of course, because people sometimes will stay there, we put a fridge in. So we are actually one of the two fridge people. We've got a little tiny sort of like, you know, dorm fridge down there. And then we've got our sort of almost regular sized fridge upstairs. I was, as soon as I read the story, like, man, we're one of those people too.
Yeah. Yeah. And there were some interesting cases that make sense, you know, culturally, people who hunt and fish, you know, they obviously like
makes sense
have
then,
a
right?
lot of meat and fish. And then they were even talking about, you know, if you're Korean and you make a lot of your own kimchi, where are you going to put that? Or if you make your own sausages, you have to have a place for that. And so I kind of felt a little more forgiving of those. I thought those were a little bit cooler than just, you know, the second, third, because some of these people have three fridges, just, you know, suburban people.
Well,
yeah, I think, you know, once you move away, when you can't, like, I can walk to the supermarket. And so I think that's probably why I tend to not bulk up quite as much.
I would also say, though, that I'm surprised that as families have gotten, well, maybe I'm not. I did offer up the big box store theory, but counter to that would be that families are actually getting smaller. I mean, when I was a kid, it wasn't unusual for a family to have three kids or four kids or five kids, especially if you're in Catholic school, right? But so almost everyone you knew, if you walked into a house, like the garbage was going to be underneath the sink and the foil was going to be in the junk drawer, was like everyone kind of organizes the same way. And you knew if it had an attached garage, that they were going to have a fridge there. You just knew, like everyone did. It was as standard as the fridge in the kitchen nearly. But that was, I always felt it was because there was a lot of people in the household, like five people in a household. You kind of need two fridges maybe.
Well, that's the fact I forgot to bring up at the beginning. It says that the households with two occupants lead in two fridge ownership. So it isn't a
crazy
family thing. Yeah, it is. People with two people living in the house have the likeliest. Yeah, they're going to have a second fridge. So, yeah, if you have a second fridge and you're listening, or if you have more, like I want to hear from people who have a crazy amount of fridges. So text us 98973. If you have more than two fridges, more than three fridges, I want to know who has the most fridges.
And also time for a quick plug for the podcast, if you want.
Yes. So my podcast, Your Last Meal, is celebrating 100 episodes this Thursday, February 25th. So if you want to get the episode right away, make sure you're subscribed. But usually I interview celebrities. This time, because it's 100, I decided to interview three 100-year-old people. And when I say people, I mean women, because the women are the only ones left at that age.
Right.
But it is a wonderful episode. They're actually all from the Seattle area. They all had really interesting lives. And then I speak with IKEA about the history of Swedish meatballs. And I speak with someone who does a podcast about eating alone, because so many people are eating alone right now. And that's something that, you know, we're not all enjoying.
That sounds fantastic.
A lot of podcasts coming your way on Thursday.
All right. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you so much.
Lots more to come on Cairo Nights. Please stay tuned.
Rachel Bell, you can ring my bell. Rachel Bell.
Welcome back to Cairo Nights. Completely honest with everyone here, I'm a bit of a nervous flyer, as much as I do enjoy having aviation experts on here. And obviously Boeing is so important to the area, important to the country, that I really dig doing stories about it, as much as sometimes the news isn't as good as we would like. This is a story that is sort of bad news with a good news core. And it was the story about, and you probably heard about it over the weekend, or maybe you did, the story of United Airlines Flight 328. United Airlines Flight 328 over the weekend, one of the engines caught fire. It was a 777. That engine essentially turned into flaming shrapnel and conked out and began disintegrating on the flight. This prompted an emergency return to the nearest possible airport by the airplane. This actually started disintegrating, caught fire and started disintegrating on takeoff. Now, obviously, I have already confessed that I'm a bit of a nervous flyer. I don't want to be the person sitting at the window when that happens. And mainly because I think I could tamp down my fear. And certainly I'd like to think that as a person who spent a long time as a reporter, I'd dutifully get my phone out and at least record what may be my final moments, hopefully just the engine's final moments for posterity. I would like to think that I would do that, but I know I would be terrified, and I think most people would be, except for the smarter folks among us, and certainly all the Boeing people who know full well one very important thing. These planes, the twin-engine planes, are designed not just to be able to fly on one engine, to complete their flight on one engine, to be able to take off, even climb on one engine. That's the way these planes are engineered right now. And so the plane did return, as you probably know, the plane did return safely. There was a lot of nervous people. There was some news reports about people not panicking. You actually listen to people who were on the flight. They sounded pretty panicked, but they stayed at least calm enough to stay in their seats, do what they were supposed to do. Obviously, there's been some pretty dramatic video of the plane flying along with, you can see the flames inside the motor and a bunch of the the shrouding of the motor is gone. That fell into Colorado, into a Colorado city, but no one was hurt on the ground. Weirdly enough, the same weekend or in the last couple of weeks, this happened a different airplane over the Netherlands. And I think a couple of people were injured. I don't think anyone seriously there when, again, a plane engine went out, disintegrated partially, and but the plane landed safely. And so all of this is to underscore one simple thing that any commercial pilot will be able to tell you, any Boeing engineer will be able to tell you. These planes are safe on one engine. Up until about 1980, there wasn't a lot of permission about just twin-engine planes doing transatlantic, transoceanic flights, because the concern was that, well, if one engine goes out, it can't continue going. But the engines are really remarkable things now. Even this Pratt & Whitney engine that is going to be, that has resulted in the grounding of all the 777s, it is considered a good engine, although now they're wondering about maybe it's a little long on the tooth. And that's why we've seen a couple of engine failures with it. These engines now are so ridiculously reliable and so ridiculously strong that they say, at least according to the airline industry people, most pilots will go their entire careers without having a single engine failure. So if you want to read a little bit more about this, what I'm going to be sort of quoting a story from Wired magazine, dynamite story. Here's the headline. Tell me you wouldn't want to read this. How planes keep flying after an engine catches fire. Now, I'm not just reading this because I want to tell you folks about it. I'm reading this so I'll remember this. Focus on this. Should I ever be in a flight where this happens? Because these are the type of things I need to cling to. So first thing. So we know that the plane has enough thrust with one engine. We've established that. But here's the rest of it. So the one, the pilot will immediately go through their checklist, and they do practice these checklists of shutting off fuel to supply to supply to that particular engine, because obviously it's not something they want to continue firing, because it's, you know, for very, very good reason. But the second thing is that you actually have a series of things that are happening to you at this point that make some sense now that I think about them, but I hadn't thought about before. And one is what it's like flying a plane with one engine. And apparently what it does is it is trying to, let's just say the right engine fails on the aircraft. If you're sitting there and think of your right-hand side, the right engine fails, the left engine is providing more thrust than the right engine at that particular point. It is trying to turn you, or what they refer to as yaw. It's trying to yaw you that direction. And so you have to, as a pilot, immediately begin kind of crabbing into that the same way you would if you're in a hard crosswind and you're driving, say, if you've ever done this, drive a van or a Volkswagen bus with a hard crosswind, you completely understand what yaw is. And that is exactly what pilots have to do. They have to deal with some of that anyway on a flight, but when you have just one engine operating, that's one of the first things that they have to compensate for. But pilots can very successfully compensate for that. People have compared it to trying to steer a shopping cart with one bum wheel. It's a little bit like that, except obviously with much bigger consequences. The other thing they have to compensate for is any sort of desire that the plane can destabilize and try to start rolling. That can put you in a situation that is what they refer to as non-recoverable. You're not flying the airplane anymore. You're gone. You're on a very, very different journey at that particular point. But it turns out that this is what everyone is saying, at least in the industry, is saying. Having that engine go out is dramatic and terrible. And really, the bigger danger is probably people on the ground as opposed to people on the aircraft, because these aircraft are so well designed that they can fly like this. The pilots are completely trained to be able to compensate for that one engine. And as the case was here in both of those cases, the planes landed successfully, which is something maybe I don't even need to talk to you folks about this. Maybe I am just telling this to me just to keep myself cool-headed. If this should ever happen on a flight, and I certainly hope that it does. Coming up, we've got a whole bunch of like small things to talk about. Actually, kind of contradictory stories today in the Seattle Times. I mean, contradictory in a broad sense about people have stopped moving to Seattle. People are not really moving away, but they're certainly not moving here yet. Separate story. Housing prices are some of the fastest rising in the country. These two things don't make a whole lot of sense. We're going to talk about that. And then a last bit on the best law in America that you probably haven't heard of yet. All coming up after the break.